Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding top professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Gary Shapiro, award-winning global top innovating thought leader, author and executive, and CEO of the Consumer Electronics Association. Gary, you just have a remarkable background, so thank you for coming in today and sharing so much with our audience.
Thank you, Stephen. It's my pleasure to be sharing with you and your audience.
Now, Gary, you're an acknowledged world leader, so can you share some highlights and useful lessons learned from your very long success history of leadership and setting standards and changing policy?
To be a successful leader, in my view, you have to be able to relate to the people that work for you and that you're trying to reach, which means treating them as humans, not as indistinguishable parts. Each one's an individual. Each one has things they're passionate about. It's up to you to determine their passions and talk to them directly. I'm also believe that becoming a black belt in Taekwondo has helped me be disciplined, understand the importance of working with others, building a team, setting goals, having a strategy, and being innovative. I mean, you have to be innovative to win. Otherwise, as I wrote just this morning on a employee review, we have to move forward because if we stagnate, we'll die.
Well, that's a remarkable background, and I don't think a lot of people would be aware that you're also a black belt in Taekwondo, so that's interesting. Now, Gary, can you share some highlights and useful lessons in addition as an internationally recognized top leader in terms of your leadership tips?
Well, this goes back to, again, being a black belt in karate, and it's the basis of why my book is called Ninja Innovation, basically leadership tips. You have to be focused, you have to be disciplined, you have to set goals, you have to take your life experiences and most of all learn from your failures, because you don't learn from your successes. They may build your confidence, but they also give a false confidence. You have to have very clear goals, and we have goals. I have individual goals in every area of my life, and we have goals for every one of our employees and for our organization, and they're SMART goals. They're specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, with a timetable, and that means with a specific time, and you have a baseline, and you see how you're going to improve. And you have to have a strategy around those goals, and that goes into the what you must do. You must be able to willing to take risks. Because those risks, either you'll succeed and you'll do something good, or you fail and you learn something. And that's what Americans, I think, are really good at, is risk-taking, as are Israelis, because they're surrounded by the possibility of death, and they have a seriousness of purpose, which I think helps them succeed. And, of course, you have to be able to have a living strategy. You have to be able to adapt. You have to adjust. You have to be willing to get out there and be the best in your field. And that takes a lot of thought. It takes a strategy. And when you have your team, you must be willing to think outside the box and know yourself and get people who complement your weaknesses rather than just try to get people who are just like you.
You know, that's interesting. You speak about SMART goals and also about diversity and much more. And you have that experience to lend that kind of lessons to our audience. Now, let's talk more about the CEA. Now, what are your three-year goals for the CEA and how will they be implemented?
Well, I don't know about our three-year goals because we don't think that way. We think long-term, medium-term, and short-term. And our long-term goals are to make sure there's an environment which encourages innovation and there's a healthy U.S. economy. So we're very focused on that. So innovation to us is the answer to a lot of the problems we face as a nation. So the biggest problem is our government and our economy. The government spends more than it makes. Now, we've encouraged solutions to that which focus on both revenue increases and spending decreases and supported various bipartisan proposals. But the truth is that the third option, which is probably the best one, and it's not mutually exclusive, is growth. Growth comes from innovation. It comes from doing and creating new things. So our main goal as an organization is to focus on how there can be an environment for innovation in this country, which allows, you know, no paths to be cut off towards the inevitable future of technology solving many of the world's problems and also creating economic growth. So certainly in the shorter term, we have to change some of the laws which are impeding innovation, whether it's the fact that, you know, patent trolls are out there putting a litigation tax on every American entrepreneur and business, that Americans used to be able to hire the best and the brightest from around the world, and now we're kicking them out of our country. We have to change those impediments to innovation. We obviously have to improve the educational system to get more STEM graduates coming from our best universities. We have to encourage more than white men to go into various studies, and we have to encourage women and benefit from the diversity that is one of the strengths of our country, and that is we have a lot of out-of-the-box thinking because we're the most heterogeneous country in the world. And, you know, we also run the world's largest innovation event, the International CES, held each January in Las Vegas, where anyone with an idea can bring it to the marketplace of over 150,000 retailers, investors, partners, CEOs from all disciplines, innovators, Wall Street, Hollywood, Madison Avenue, and they see what's going on. We want to make sure that event stays healthy, strong, and is run so that anyone with an idea can get access and show that idea very inexpensively. We're also, planning on various roadmaps to what we think is the future success in some certain areas. There's a lot of unknown areas, but in certain areas, for example, we know that driverless cars provide a solution to a lot of society's problems involving car accidents, involving texting while driving, distracted driving, and also when we get there, they will free up a lot of time for people to use productively rather than being stuck in traffic. That's important to us. We know that the Internet of Things is coming as products talk to each other, and that will solve problems. We know that it's part of that as well. Digital health and digital fitness and medicine is going to be very important. So technology which saves lives, and also technology which works in agriculture, in education, things that will create unique solutions, low cost, allow anyone in the world to have access to information, education, and technology, solve plumbing problems, things like that that a lot of the rest of the world is behind on, and technology will provide an answer to. So that is basically our midterm goals to long-term goals, I would say, for CEA, is to make sure that everyone in the world benefits from innovation and that we do what we can to make sure government doesn't mess it up, government does some good things which will ease innovation, and that we're out there, frankly, fighting against the legacy industries that are always trying to protect themselves against some new industry which is going to come along because of innovation.
No, that's fascinating. Those are some really great goals for the CEA. Now, earlier you also talked about the International CES, and that's the premier event in the world. Can you talk about some of your longer-term goals for that event?
Sure. We are always trying to set the bar higher, and it's daunting because we've just come off a phenomenally successful event. Over 3,500 companies were exhibiting something, and we had over 150,000 people from around the world, including actually over 40,000 people from outside the United States. But we never rest on our laurels. We're always trying to improve the event. We're always surveying our customers and potential customers and getting input. And we want to make sure that we represent the entire consumer technology ecosystem. That means staying on top of technology trends. Certainly, I talked about automotive earlier, but there's gaming. There's this concept which is, I think, going to change the world called 3D printing, which is just in its infancy and will certainly grow very quickly. And that's important for us to always get it better, and we just want to make sure that it's a great experience in Las Vegas. And we're going around the world and making sure different parts of the world have a little bit of a taste of CES, so they'll be focused and thinking about innovation and about how they could bring their innovations to market.
You know, I was at CES, and I was just amazed at all the innovation that was displayed there, and spent quite a bit of time at Eureka Park, and even saw this rapid increase of crowdfunding taking over in many ways. So I would recommend the audience to take a look. It's well worth participating, being an active contributor to the event. Now, you are this, as I mentioned, global leader in so many different ways in policy and so on. What are your views on global challenges and their solutions?
Well, a lot of the global challenges boil down to the fact that people, because of technology, see that there are people that are benefiting enormously. They're fairly wealthy. They're doing well, and there's a focus increasingly on wealth disparity. To me, it's sometimes unfortunate because that focus gets determined as that there are people who are too wealthy compared to people that are too poor. When in reality, the causes of wealth and the causes of poverty are two totally different things. In some cases that I appreciate, wealth does. It comes about because you create something which people want. So, a significant number of the wealthiest people in the world actually have created innovative technologies like, the Jobs, Steve Jobs and his family, Bill Gates, Larry Ellison, and others have created companies and innovations which people have bought. And that's a good thing. We have to encourage that. And, you know, what level they're taxed and things like that is not something I'll focus on, but we just never want to discourage people from creating wealth and demonize them because they've done something good. Poverty, on the other hand, especially in the United States, comes from a range of socioeconomic factors, which have to do with family structures, disincentive systems, basically cycles of poverty, young women having kids at a very young age, single, not eating well, and a lack of opportunity perhaps for younger kids that they see a way out. And we have to change and work on those things. Globally, in each country almost, there's a different story. Poverty obviously can come from, you know, it starts at the, you could work down the Maslow hierarchy of needs. I mean, you have to start with food supply. No one in the world should be going hungry at this point. Certainly no one in the U.S. You need access to medical care. And I mean, I think Americans would agree that no one should have, be denied access to medical care and should provide them. And you know, that's a fundamental way that Obamacare has never been positioned. So I think the biggest global challenges, whether they be disease or poverty, agriculture, a water supply, things like that, there are technological solutions coming about rapidly. It's a matter of making sure that governments don't stand in the way and, in fact, help provide access to them. And that's the global challenge I think we face.
Now, as I mentioned, that was at the International CES, and there's a lot of innovation and entrepreneurship on display. And you are sort of the premier thought leader in this space. Can you talk about some of your tips for innovation and entrepreneurship?
Well, first of all, you mentioned the fact that you were at Eureka Park, which is a relatively new, it's just 3 years old, portion of our event that we open to startups only, and they're curated. They have to have various criteria. We work with Startup America and the National Science Foundation. We work with Indiegogo, which is a financing website for entrepreneurs. And we have over 200 companies that we're showing, and by all accounts, phenomenally well. I mean, I heard from someone this morning that said they had every major retailer come by, and many of them put orders in for their new product, which was, you know, just a guy from Colorado with an idea. I've heard from people in Eastern Europe with great ideas about that they were there. So we encourage people from all over the world to participate in that. But, you know, the way... If you have an idea, obviously there's a challenge you face. Is sometimes your family and your friends are discouraging you, and you have to sometimes shut those people out and go for your passion and your idea if you thought it through. On the other hand, when you go to a place like Eureka Park and you spend 4 days getting input from people who are buyers and media and investors and potential partners, they will give you input, and you have to have your ears open. It used to be you had an idea and people would say you need a lengthy business plan. You know, you need to consider all these things. You need to write it out. That's less important now, frankly, than talking to people, testing your idea, getting input, and readjusting. Because no one ever lived by their business plan. You always adjusted when you got in the marketplace. So the key is to get to the marketplace quicker. And you don't have to do it with the investment necessarily. You might just do a prototype. You might have some idea. And then get feedback and adjust, because you always have to adjust. So, you know, the thing is, if you're an entrepreneur, you know, there's a lot of great ideas out there. Execution is also difficult, but you got a reality test. You have to invest. You have to be creative. You have to figure out a way to do it. Sometimes it's better to do it when you're in a life situation which allows you to do it. For example, when you're younger, you don't have family responsibilities, or when you're older, or you may be laid off from a job, or you may be unemployed. It's, you know, there's a tremendous amount of entrepreneurship because of necessity. We, you know, statistically, immigrants are great entrepreneurs. They have sometimes less to lose. And it's tougher to be an entrepreneur when you have a lot to lose. So it's you have to really know yourself really well, do some honest self-examination. Talk to some people with an objective view who are entrepreneurs that you trust. Get involved with different entrepreneur organizations. See what's available in terms of resources, like trade shows like the CES, which are a phenomenally cost-effective way of getting a tremendous amount of market response in a very short period of time. And go to other events and open your mind.
You know, it's interesting. You're talking about getting feedback, so I guess that speaks to customer development from Steve Blank, or the business model canvas from Alexander Osterwalder, or even Eric Ries' Lean Startup. Now, I'm going to broaden this question a bit. What areas continue to surprise you?
You know, I just amazed at the developments in the sciences, whether it's in the biological area, the health areas. I was just at the Computer History Museum and seeing the development of technology in the last 100 years and where we're going under Moore's Law. And, you know, there's a theoretical limit we're hitting in terms of processing speed. But one of the big areas that I think is growing, is changing the world, is microelectromechanical systems. These are the small subcomponents, which are sensing devices. They're accelerometers, gyroscopes, even temperature sensing, blood sensing. There's all sorts of sensing devices that are coming out which measure things. And they measure them almost at the molecular level. And these NEMs, these little components that companies make, have become microscopic and inexpensive. And there's very clever ways of putting them as devices. And you combine those with what's going on in the biology and the health area. And we're entering, you know, literally a tremendous period of innovation where we are just starting out, and there's going to be tremendous ability to monitor the body, to get solutions, to do things, to improve, for bodies to talk to machines, to include the doctor only when it's essential. So we're just crawling in this world of innovation and technology, and we're going to solve a lot of the big problems. And to me, the big problems are, you know, the fact that people are suffering from lack of food, lack of medical care, lack of water, lack of health care. And we could solve these problems. I'm sure we'll have other problems that are geopolitical and things like that, which I'm really not that good at solving, although I am passionate about the fact that people are doing business with each other, they're less likely to be fighting each other. So I'm a big passionate believer in free trade, and free trade also in free movement of people around, free movement in education, things like that. But in terms of technology, being able to solve problems, that is my personal passion and belief. And I'm happy to surprise about all these new disciplines of science which are merging different areas in terms of whether it's genetics or learning or education and biology and things like that, or mapping the genome and predictive sciences of what health risks you face and how to solve them.
Now, you talked about innovation already quite a bit, and you've mentioned some of those in the prior questions. Do you have any other sort of what you see as disruptive innovations coming up?
Well, I did mention 3D printing, and it's just the ability to create anything in your own home. So right now it's just some plastics pretty much, but there's some food getting into there, especially sugars and chocolates and things like that. But obviously if you get different componentry that you could put in there, different ingredients, whether they be biological or food, you have the ability to create almost anything in your home, which is quite startling. And there'll be technologies which allow you even to shift from what you create, from your refrigerator to your oven, and, you know, perhaps make a dinner. But the future to me is that today, if you want to buy something or get something that you need, you know, you go to the store, you order it online. Those are your choices. I guess, you know, 40, 50 years ago, you'd go to the store or you'd have someone knock on your door, and a door-to-door salesman. You know, but 20 years from now, or even 10 years from now, you might have a choice of three ways of getting it in your home. You could have it delivered by a drone. You could make it in your home with a 3D printer. Or you could have a driverless car deliver it. So things are changing rather rapidly, and that has all sorts of ramifications for society in many, many different ways. 3D printing. Ultra high definition is clearly, you know, new video display technology that's really going to take off and dominate in the next several years. The Internet of Things will obviously be big in terms of how our homes and appliances get smarter, and they'll predict, they'll adjust to our daily routine, they'll help us. And obviously wearables in so many different ways, from clothes that could change their color to change their vents based on the temperature, to do all sorts of things to adjust to you and your needs, or even monitor you based on your high blood pressure. And these are little tiny wearables and big wearables, and include things like the things you could put around your wrist, or Google Glass and other competitors around your eyes or other parts of your body, or even ingest them and they'll tell you things. So we have some real opportunities that are coming out there. And, of course, there's a lot of things I just don't know about things that will be invented, and no one is smart enough to predict the course of innovation, which is a jagged course. I view my job as making sure that course be allowed to exist, and we have the ingredients in place so people can innovate and create.
Now, one of the things I was struck with, at the International CES was the growth of the China region, and the fact that, I guess, purchases of consumer electronic components exceeded in the U.S. last year. And so what are the top growth regions internationally based on your experiences?
Well, when you say growth, I assume you mean, you know, economies are growing quicker than others, and the easy answer is the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And certainly if you look at the size of their population, the size of their economy, the absolute growth, those are pretty high. I mean, and very significant. They're developing economies that are doing very well, and they have great purchasing power. But in terms of innovation growth, having a couple of books out about innovation and going around the world and the United States and talking to different places, I would not identify those countries as the top growth areas for innovation. China especially is, although they desperately want to be innovative, it's tough to be innovative when you have a government that's focused on, you know, cutting off access to different internet sites, that promotes a culture of theft and stealing, and it's difficult. And a lot of the top Chinese scientists want to come here in the United States, so they want to go elsewhere and they want to stay elsewhere. But they have sheer numbers which are overwhelming. But they are struggling for innovation. But their 10-year goal, for example, is to have a certain number of patents per 10,000 people. And their strategy to get there is to school a lot of people, especially in the United States. They have over 200,000 people here. And because they know they're not innovative, they're either trying to steal or they're trying to get younger people here to learn how we're innovative. And they're getting really young when they're coming here. So that's their strategy. It's not one I totally respect or understand even fully. Brazil has they're doing pretty well, but they've built a big blockade around the country for tariff purposes, and that's hurting them. They're slowing down. Their government faces some challenges. India faces infrastructure challenges, but it's a highly educated population. And Russia is, clearly has some corruption issues, some problems in their own governance. Although it's a fairly bright, educated people, it's tough to get around the corruption. But I'm seeing some real healthy growth from, surprisingly to me, France, for example, which I have actually was more pessimistic about just a few years ago, because they are a very sensual country. They work off the five senses with their great food and wine and perfume and fashion and visuals, and they're translating that into some innovation in related and other areas. Also, some of the Eastern European countries are playing off the fact that technically they're very good. They have great computer scientists, and they're starting to create things which are really good. And, you know, of course, in the U.S. we talk about Silicon Valley, but there's hotspots all around the United States, whether it's biotech in San Diego and in Maryland, or it's IT in Northern Virginia and in Seattle. I mean, there's all sorts of places around the United States which have pockets focused on often great universities and a number of companies working together in various ways to create an ecosystem promoting innovation.
Now, what kind of improvements would you like to see in policy in the next 2 years in your country, and how about internationally?
Well, again, you have to recognize, and I think we're almost there, I think President Obama has spoken a very good game on it, that you have to focus on innovation as a policy. Now, many of the Europeans take that and they prepare these lengthy documents with government funding and things like that and picking winners and losers, which I do not think is the way to go. I think the way to go is to encourage local innovation and to figure out, let localities figure out what they're good at and develop their own plans to try to attract businesses and investment. And if you are, as you know, President Obama insisted on doing with Solyndra and others, if you want to pick winners and losers, don't have government, 28-year-old kids who got political jobs picking them to really fashionable stuff like solar power. Have venture capitalists put in some of their own money and match it and invest that way. I'm very big on crowdfunding. We pushed the Jobs Act through to allow crowdsourcing of funding. Also, we have to deal with the patent system. We have to deal with our immigration problems. But, you know, a lot of times people talk a good game. One of the areas we have to resolve or continue to work on is there is a tension between existing businesses protected by government fiat, whether they be broadcasters or copyright owners or even cable systems and others, and newcomers to the marketplace. You even see this in things you wouldn't consider technology. For example, Uber is a great company allowing unused limousine drivers to efficiently work all the time and make money, but they're always being opposed by taxi cab commissions trying to protect, you know, the existing bad but cheaper service of taxi cabs. And so we're seeing this all the time with innovation. Very creative approaches come in. Existing business models use government to try to protect themselves. I just think we need to first acknowledge innovation is important, provides new services, and really live off the American policy is that business models and businesses can go away. It's not the job of government to protect existing businesses. It's the job to encourage competition and new things, and we are a society of creative destruction.
Now, Gary, we're down to our last question, and this one's somewhat open-ended in that I'm turning the tables. I'm saying that if you were conducting this interview, what one question would you have asked, and then what would be your answer?
Why aren't you running everything is one question. Since you seem to have all the answers, and I'd rather advocate them in my position where I have a platform to do so and not have to deal with the hassles of trying to forge political consensus in a country where there's two diametrically opposed parties with extremists in both.
Well, Gary, I know your schedule is demanding. You've got to go, so I thank you for taking the time to do this interview and sharing your many deep experiences with our audience.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and we could always be reached at CE.org, and if people care about innovation, they could sign up as a national strategy. They could sign up at our innovation movement, and it's a free type of thing, and it's several hundred thousand Americans at this point pushing just the type of things I'm talking about, is that our future is tied to innovation.
Well, thank you again, and I want to close by saying I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Gary Shapiro, award-winning global top innovating thought leader, best-selling author and executive, and CEO of the Consumer Electronics Association.